This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of San Francisco. This episode is sponsored by the University of San Francisco's master's degree in applied economics and USF's Center on Business Studies and Innovation. My guest today is Martin Peitz, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim and a director of the Mannheim Center for Competition and Innovation. He is an expert on competition and regulation, particularly in digital markets, who frequently advises and trains government agencies in Europe and around the world on these topics. In addition to his numerous academic journal publications on these topics, he's also the co-author of a widely used textbook on industrial organization. I've invited him on today to talk about his newest textbook, The Economics of Platforms, Concepts and Strategies, which was published last year by Cambridge University Press. I used it myself for teaching this semester and highly recommend it. Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. So let's just start with the basics. You know, some of our listeners are economists or have some training in that, but others are not, or maybe, you know, only took a class many years ago and haven't kept up with trends. So first of all, what is a platform?
Well, it's not that easy. I guess you can ask a number of people and we'll get different answers. We, of course, decided on a particular definition, and you can opt for a different one. For us, the key element of platforms are, first of all, the presence of network effects, which means that my decision will be affected by participation decisions and usage decisions of others, and the fact that this platform is actually managing those network effects. So it takes a very active role in, for example, steering buyers to sellers, or leading to interaction, say, on a communication platform.
Okay, so that differs from just being a marketplace. Like, so you could say, you know, whatever, a farmer's market or an old-fashioned tourist bazaar is kind of a, some people call that a platform because it gathers people together and they make exchanges. Would that fall into your category?
So at the basic level, it does satisfy it, especially if you can control entry. You can do this through price, for example. So thereby, you're affecting the number of participants, say how many people are there as sellers, vendors, how many people are buyers. So at the basic level, this is a platform. It's a very basic one where there may be just a pricing instrument, but there may be a bit more. You may have some people standing outside taking a look at who's trying to enter and take out those, deny access to those people who may who look like that they may create trouble. So then we do have indeed already a non-price element in there, and this does lead to a, in a way, to a management of network effects. So you may have then fewer users, but in a way the quality of those users are better from the viewpoint of the others who want to interact. So I would say that does satisfy my definition of the platform. It doesn't probably explain why we are nowadays much more concerned about platforms than, say, 20 or 30 years ago. It's not just that we, in a way, invented this notion about 20 years ago. I think now we are living with animals where this management of network effects has become much more important.
Yeah, so that was my next question. So you know, as I indicated, you know, marketplaces in some form with some kind of governance or pricing to, you know, decisions about who can participate and who can't have been around for, you know, centuries or millennia. But, you know, this idea of platforms is definitely a newer concept. So why is that? Why is this a big new area of study?
So I think the platforms nowadays affect larger part of our life. So it means we have now active intermediaries, and many of our interactions and transactions depend on the governance of these platforms.
And nowadays, why don't you just name off some of the major ones, just so people...
Yeah, so, I mean, take as a very basic example, if we take Google Search as a way to discover the world, but also to discover products. So there, clearly, the Google algorithm plays an extremely important role to decide on what we are going to see, which then affects our search behavior. And it's just a fraction of what is around, what we will ever see. And clearly, the algorithm is deciding on what we will see.
So then right. So that's one important platform. And then I guess, would you classify, companies like Uber and Lyft that, you know, connect buyers and sellers of a service, or Airbnb, would also be platforms. Would you call Facebook a platform in your framing?
So I start with the last one. So I think there have been some disagreements of whether Facebook is a platform. So some people say, well, it's just a social network. Well, at least in the early days, it was just a social network. But from my point of view, it's not really necessary to be able to isolate different groups which interact with each other, but it's just the mere fact that there is this group interaction which matters, and that this group interaction is managed, which makes the entity a platform. So I think there's some different notions in the literature. So I distinguish those type of platforms. And then if they are separate groups or sites, as it's often said, then I would call them actually a multi-sided or a two-sided platform.
Right. So, yeah. So why don't we talk more about, you mentioned the idea of network effects. So why don't we introduce those? So what's the basic idea of network effects?
So the notion of network effects has been formally used in economics at some point in the second half of the last century, 1970s. And these were communication networks at that point, landline telephones. And there the idea is that each additional person joining allows for additional communication possibilities also for those who are actually already on the network. And this then generates network effects. And why does that matter? Well, it matters because if I'm making my participation decision, I may just look at my own benefit, perhaps at the benefit of some very close by, say some members of family, but I may ignore the effect of me joining the network on those which are further away from me. And so that means there is the risk that there is an under-provision, that too few people will actually join because they don't really include those network effects. And that's, I think, right, where the formal economic analysis, the economic theory of networks started.
Right. And so then a key characteristic of this, right, so you might have under provision and also kind of an accelerating level of participation once you maybe hit some threshold where, you know, to be the third person on a telephone network is not really worth much effort or much cost. But once there's, you know, 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people on it, then it becomes much more valuable.
Perhaps before thinking about dynamics, one can think about, well, what could really happen in a stable scenario? And one feature in the presence of network effects is that there are often what we call multiple equilibria, meaning multiple situations where nobody has an incentive to revise its decision. So if everybody thinks that this network is nobody is going to use that network, well, then nobody will join, and that remains a stable situation. However, if sufficient people are convinced that this network will take off, people will use it, then indeed it will be used and everybody will be happy about it. And then we can think about the dynamics. So there is the risk to be locked into a situation where there's nobody or very few people joining that network, or there is the possibility that people coordinate on a situation in which indeed many people are joining. And things become more complicated if it's not just one network, but when people have to choose between different networks. And there the risk is that people actually coordinate on the inferior network, the one which actually provides less utility. But if everybody thinks that's the one people will use, then people are staying there. And I think that's part of the discussion when we move quickly into the current century and competition between platforms. There is the concern that people stay with an incumbent platform and they are hesitant to move to a newcomer simply because they don't know whether other people will be moving as well.
Right. And you can certainly see that, you know, concretely now, if you follow Twitter, there's all this discussion of, I mean, 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, as the sale was finalized, many people saying, oh, well, now everyone's going to have to leave Twitter because it's not going to be, you know, good anymore. And so people setting up accounts on Mastodon or proposing other networks, but yet Twitter still seems just as active because if everyone is, you know, even if they have half a foot out the door, but they're still checking, then you can pretty much find out everything that you would find out on Twitter. And then moving to a smaller network, even if you like the moderation policy or something else better there, is just hard because everyone else is still doing the other thing.
Yes, so I think it depends very much on the specific content. And you can imagine there have been some examples in the past where people actually did move quickly. But then there are others, many others, where people haven't been moving, indeed.
Yeah, so how does that... let's step back to the purpose and audience of your book to frame things a little bit more. So who is it intended for? Who do you think?
Well, of course, since I would like to convince everybody, I should say it's for everybody. And I mean, since there are network effects, you will benefit, especially if many other people are also reading this book. On a more concrete level, we have two broad audiences in mind. One, first is economic students or students taking courses in economics or related. I know it has the book is also partly used in management, who are, however, interested in a somewhat formal approach. So we do have some formulas in there, some small models to work through. So that's one audience. And the second audience, which we are also addressing, are people working in practice, competition, economics, people working for consultancies, people working in agencies, particular competition authorities.
Mm-hmm. And is the goal for them to, is it a how-to manual? Is it, you know, you mentioned it's formal, so there are some short case studies, but it's really based on, as we do as economists, explaining kind of the underlying conceptual frameworks, right?
Yes, it's really a focus on mechanisms, and those mechanisms are then, in a way, made concrete through formal models and illustrated through small cases. Yes.
And so so it could be useful both for someone taking the perspective of, I mean, obviously for anyone who's just interested in academically understanding things, but as you said, like from a regulatory perspective of how do we, you know, set up a regulatory environment where the best elements of these platforms can flourish and we can take advantage of them without, you know, creating problems. And then also maybe more from the sort of MBA business management side, understanding if you're working in one of those or even interacting with one of them as a participant, then how should you understand them and how can you strategically deal with them? So let's take it from the some of the questions you have here, which are maybe more relevant from the business perspective. So you mentioned like the dynamic situation, like how do you what are some of the challenges of growing a platform? You have this equilibrium where no one's on your platform because no one's on your platform and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, or where everyone's on your platform, even if it's terrible, maybe, and that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. But how do you go from one to the other?
Yeah, so I think the first one, which is the one which probably means less direct involvement in those interactions, is trying to do expectation management. So it's all about convincing people that something will work, and there, in a way, precedent can help. So what we have seen is that some successful platforms, they entered one market. It perhaps took them a while. Say a national market, particular country. But when they were successful there, they were much more quickly successful in other markets which they entered afterwards. And this can have several reasons. One reason is that perhaps their product, their offering was already improved since they could experiment in the first market. I had to experiment to see what works best, and to the extent that the other country has, that people in the other country have similar preferences, that would then also work well somewhere else. But I think the second element, which is very important, is the one about expectations. If you see, oh, this company has been successful in the US and now they're entering some European markets, well, then the expectation is that's the one which will make it. So therefore, I should move soon. No more personal engagement or investment of my time with the local hero of the day, but rather switch or at least add as an additional platform the offering from abroad. And this is, if you look at the history of Facebook, the success story of Facebook, that they were able to quickly wipe out national heroes in some of the European countries. These were social networks which had, say, 80-90% of the market at that time, and they were gone in a matter of months or at least, say, 1 or 2 years. So that shows that these network effects can be actually rather dangerous for the winner of the day if there's somebody from outside who can kind of turn things upside down and make these network effects work in favor of itself. So that's one element of dynamics. If you're in a strong position somewhere, which may be a region or a country, or it may be a certain area, take Amazon in books, and they were able then to move into other product categories, they not only gain experience, they may have some economies of scale and scope in their operations, but on top of that, they may be more easily able to convince consumers to move. The second one is, of course, product differentiation, how you can become successful. You offer something which works particularly well for a particular niche, which may already be catered for by some more general purpose platform, but participants may not be extremely happy with it. And then if you have a tailor-made offer to make, you may be able to move consumers despite consumers or all the participants, despite the coordination problem. One example for this was the second, some kind of artisan products, which used to be sold on eBay, and then most of that traffic moved to Etsy. So what we have seen there, a small newcomer was able, with a better offer, to make people move. So that's another possible successful entry strategy.
So what did Etsy do to, you know, because you could sell your stuff on eBay before. So what did Etsy do that made it a better venue that people would move to, despite, and at least initially, I assume, not having the same scope of a market?
Yeah, the eBay format of selling things was kind of one size fits all, and sellers couldn't provide sufficient information on those products, so they felt constrained, and that apparently limited trade because there wasn't enough information made available on eBay, and Etsy had this special group or this special category in mind, and therefore allowed for much more information transmission.
Right.
Between sellers and buyers.
Right. And because Etsy, it's like a lot of customized things. So sort of just using words, like I guess with words, you could say this is a 1972 baseball trading card from this person or something like that. And that could work on eBay. But if you're talking about, like, I made a cute little black cat piece of pottery with something on it, then it's much harder without, like, lots of pictures and an explanation to sort of figure out.
Yeah, and a way to associate with the seller and things like that. Exactly.
Yeah.
And of course, one should see, I mean, this is some years ago, so one should also look at how eBay was operating at that point. And Etsy apparently found a way of making both buyers and sellers happier and therefore increasing the volume of trade. So if we move to particular types of platforms, Etsy would be one of them, which are two-sided platforms, buyers and sellers interacting with each other. Another way of getting started and overcoming the problem of coordinating on a good equilibrium is actually to partially vertically integrate, meaning that the platform takes an active position itself. And that's what we have been seeing a lot in the video game industry, where some platform manufacturers also invested in games, not to dominate the whole thing, but to convince independent game developers to become active on their platform. So the network story goes as follows. If we have such a game console put on the market, and there are some most likely very successful games already available made by the console maker itself, this will convince sufficiently many consumers to buy the console, and that prospect then convinces game developers in return to independent game developers to have games for that platform available as well.
Right. Although then there's also the other strategy of trying to keep everything in-house and sort of not allow anyone else onto your platform to preserve that kind of monopoly status with that.
Definitely.
Platform.
So it's not necessarily the model which is taken, and that may be time dependent. If we look at Amazon initially as a retailer, so there was no other seller out there. And then later on, Amazon opened its marketplace to let independent sellers enter. So initially it was this kind of closed, in that sense, vertically integrated, that the platform only had its own products for resale. Whereas at a later point, the marketplace was opened and third-party sellers were invited.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And I guess that, and then another angle that often comes up, especially, you know, here in Silicon Valley, is the just venture capital, the role of venture capital, where, you know, if you want to get something started up, they just aggressively spend lots and lots and lots of money to, you know, make it attractive, to let everyone know that it's attractive, and also just to create that self-fulfilling prophecy of, well, people are spending billions of dollars on it, so it must be, you know, it must be a big deal. It's going to be established.
Yes, I think that culture, I think, works very well with industries where network effects are pronounced, especially if there is something of a first mover advantage, so that even though it can go the other way, that it tends to be that these network effects tend to go in favor of those who are first in. And in that case, it is just essential to scale up and also to devote all energy on making a product or a service which will be adapted by as many people as possible quickly, and think about making money at a later point in time.
Mm-hmm. Although some of them seems like they're the later point in time still is forever later. They're having trouble making that shift.
I guess we're also talking about some platforms where people are actually astonished by the huge amounts of profits they make. And in the end, of course, for many of those at the early days, it's a bet, and only few bets will pay off. But some of them do quite nicely.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's a fundamental it's fundamental of, I guess, technologies. But yeah, as you said, with the network effects, kind of adds that extra level of where it really is just a roll of the dice.
Getting back to the network effect story, so the stuff we are also covering in this book, what we are seeing is that some platforms are growing in a way that they're adding sides. I think, again, the Amazon might be an example that it's adding third-party sellers. It is adding or has been adding also certain service providers. We have seen it with also social networks, where we were saying it's first just this network, but then the advertiser side was added. Arguably, there's a separate influencer side. Certain types of content providers are added. So what is used to be a platform in which participants were all treated similarly, it has become a much more complex system to run, where the governance plays out not just on the consumer side, but also with specific offers to separate groups. And this can go in the way, as I mentioned, adding groups, but it may also be that what used to be one group is kind of separated into multiple groups. If you think about YouTube or some of the other streaming platforms with user-generated content, well, the idea was, well, we can upload our own stuff. But some people actually became pretty good at that. And this became then a separate group, which was then also separately targeted or managed by the platform.
Right. Let's actually let's step back and make sure people didn't miss that, because I don't think we introduced the idea of multi-sided platforms very well. So the one-sided network effect is just straightforward, like the telephone network, or, you know, your family and your friends being on Facebook, where just more or less the more people are on it, the more valuable it is for you. And then kind of the for me, the simplest example of two-sided network effects that I always teach with is just to think about Uber, right? If there's a whole lot of the riders don't really care how many other riders there are, they care how many, you know, drivers there are, and the drivers care how many riders there are. So you need to get more drivers to get more riders to get more drivers. And so it's, you know, that complicates the, so you have these two-sided network effects where you care about the other side's presence more. So what are some of the other major issues in that you cover in your book, or sort of considerations, or
yeah, so the Uber example works, perhaps with a caveat that I actually do care about the other riders, because my chance of getting a ride may depend also on how unique in a way I am. So there are certain elements also of within our group network effects present on Uber. And that also holds for standard e-commerce platforms, where you first think about the buyer-seller interaction, but to the extent that there is seller competition, I do care also about what is happening on my own side. But at least as a first starting point, focus on the interaction between different groups. There, building up a platform, there this element of vertical integration I was mentioning just before is a particularly relevant one, because I have this problem. I have to convince two groups to join, which these groups may be possible that I think about my family or acquaintances, what would they do, and perhaps we can somehow coordinate. But with different groups, buyers and sellers, it seems this coordination problem may actually be more problematic. There are many other issues which are arising once you have multi-sided platform. And if you look at the theoretical literature, which became extremely successful and influential starting essentially at the year 2000, or with the main publication 2003, is trying to understand, when you have multiple sides, how do you want to price? So what is the pricing structure? Who pays more? Which side pays more? And it is important there to understand that what we often might think when there are different prices out there, there may be cross-subsidization, by which we mean that one side pays less, possibly even less than the cost. Well, this may be the optimal strategy for a platform, and even for a social planner, even for a government trying to maximize social welfare. And the reason are, again, network effects. Because what some users in one group benefit from the other use may be very from the users in the other group may be very different from how these other users are viewing the interaction possibilities. Very good example are traditional media platforms, where as a user we typically don't like advertising or even dislike advertising. So in, say, commercial television. Whereas advertisers are keen to get access to those consumers. So that means that the network effect from consumers to advertisers is positive. Advertisers like to be on a platform with more users, whereas more consumers or viewers, whereas consumers are actually happier on a platform where there's less advertising. There we see it's very natural to have a very asymmetric pricing structure, namely the advertisers should pay. These are the ones who are actually interested in being on this platform and getting access to consumers, whereas consumers, I mean, they are suffering from advertising, so therefore they may get a subsidy or at least free content.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, and so that's definitely the most clear illustration of that. None of us really enjoy advertising, but we put up with it as the implicit price of the service, but not the explicit price. I guess the other thing people, you know, say is, in some sense, certain sense, you're paying with your data by revealing your behavior and your preferences on the platform, and that also being used to target the advertising.
So this very basic example, so with traditional commercial television, there wasn't much data. So there you essentially, if you want, pay with your attention. Mm-hmm. And then the data aspect is an additional one, which plays out much more prominently with the digital platforms we're talking about, where those data provide an advantage for a number of reasons to those platforms which get access to those data. So it may improve their monetization possibility on with that particular service because they just provide, for example, better targeted advertising. So we are not suffering for more advertising, but the advertisers which reach us are the ones who are really keen on reaching us, and therefore they're willing to pay a higher price. And so that's how these data then play out. Or those data may actually be used for other services which are not directly related to the one where those data were generated. So there may be just a data sale, and then those data may also become attractive. Mm-hmm. And it can, of course, improve the overall performance also from a consumer perspective. So these data, in some cases, take Amazon, are used to make consumers also better off, for example, by getting better recommendations, possibly by filtering out unreliable ratings, so making the rating systems more precise. So all these are ways in which the platform actively can generate network effects, strengthen network effects. That's actually, I think, an important starting point, and therefore we dedicate a full chapter of the book on how platforms, through their decisions, affect the strength of network effects. And the two examples where the two applications we look at in more detail are recommender systems and rating systems.
Right. So what are some of the key features of those recommender and rating systems that you highlight in the book?
So what we try to do there is to see to what extent are there really network effects. For example, if I leave my data and to the platform, and then the platform can use those data and provide me with something which works better and perhaps doesn't even rely on data collected from somebody else, then the data are relevant for the quality of the recommendations I receive, but they're not really network effects present. So network effects happen if my data are also useful to provide better recommendations to others. And where we see this, where it at least in principle can happen, as an example, would be Amazon, where Amazon makes recommendations of what I may want to buy based on what others bought who showed similar purchase interest as I did. So there, the use of the data from the whole group allows the platform to make better recommendations. What we do in the book is, on the one hand, just show how a platform which wants to provide the best experience, how it would organize and manage such, say, recommender systems, and what implications this has. For example, there has been the question, is it now possible that the type of products we're buying looks very different than in a world in which such recommender systems did not exist? And there are arguments that and also empirical studies which show that in some instances, at least, small items, niche items, have a better chance to be found and therefore be bought. And this may lead to more diversity of products for us in the marketplace. And what
right.
we also
and I guess
do, that's- mm-hmm. what we also do in the book is then to look at to what extent a extreme a monopoly platform, or more generally, you should think about a platform with market power, has an incentive to actually bias this. So it's in a way sacrifices the quality of the overall system in order to make more money.
Right, because I know because I have that market power, because of the network effects are so strong, even if your platform becomes no longer the best platform in some dimensions or sacrifice some quality and skews the choice of products, but I'm still going to go there because everything else about it is because it's the place to go.
Yes, it may be due to network effects, maybe, of course, due to other, there may be other reasons why I want to go to this platform. There may be also scale economies involved. Amazon has an excellent logistics system. So there may be other reasons of why I want to go to a particular platform. And the platform has to be very careful, so it can't sacrifice everything. In the end, it is overall consumer experience which drives consumers to a particular platform. But with market power, you can give up a bit. I mean, it's the same thing as if you just set a price, if you charge an infinite price, you won't, even as a monopolist, you won't have anybody buying it. And but you can charge definitely more than a competitive price.
Right. So why don't we talk about, actually, the last interview I did was with Ann Kokas, who's a scholar of communications. But her most recent book is called Trafficking Data, and is talking about the interrelationship between the U.S. and Chinese and worldwide data ecosystems, or whatever you want to call them. And one of the concerns that she expressed in the book is that because in China, there's more access to data. There's less sort of privacy, consumer privacy protections, and also that the government is requiring companies to house their data there, that they're going to get sort of a long-term advantage over over Western companies. I don't know if you have a view on that particular issue, but I'm curious in general, like how you see the emergence of the major Chinese platforms onto the world stage as affecting. How you see that playing out, or what people should be looking for?
Well, I think I'm mostly looking at competition problems, and what has been said in a number of policy discussions is, well, just look around. We are seeing a lot of competitors emerging to some of the big digital players based in the U.S. And the question is then, well, where did those grow? If it is really a prerequisite to be able to challenge one of the existing large players to have been growing up and experimenting and building up a business model in China, if that's the prerequisite to be successful elsewhere in the world, then I would not think that we have solved the competition problem. So I think... to that extent, I am concerned about the possibility of challenging currently very strong players. This should be possible also for players emerging new in the US, in Europe, or anywhere else, but in an area where they are already competing with the currently strong players, and not in China, where they're not competing against Google, Facebook, and so on.
Okay, so the fact that TikTok can challenge YouTube and Facebook and so on, kind of reduce their monopoly power, is not on the one sense, to the extent that we think competition in these markets is good to discipline all the players to provide a higher quality or lower priced product, it seems good, but you're saying that it could only emerge in the kind of protected network of China, and so by having that home base to grow on, then it can expand outwards. But that's not something we want to rely on as the only source of competitive pressure for U.S. and European firms.
I think yes, for a number of reasons, that's not the only type of competitive pressure we would like to have. So when we talk about a market being possibly contestable, meaning that newcomers have with a good product or service have a chance of success, then this should not require them to be first building up their base somewhere where they are protected, or at least not face the existing large competitor, and rather should be able to make this success happen being based and rolling out things in Europe or the US.
Okay. And so so this book doesn't mainly talk about regulation. Is that so? But that's going to be your next book, is that right?
So that's work in progress. So we are currently working on a second book where we are much more looking at competition and the regulatory landscape. There has been a good reason why this comes in two books. The first reason is that we were slow and wanted to at least have the conceptual issues out there. And the second reason is that there has been quite some movement on the regulatory scene. There are interesting competition cases. So in that sense, I think it's even worth the wait because, for example, in Europe, we now know how the Digital Market Act at least looks in print, how it will be dealt with, that we still have to wait a bit, but at least we know what we're talking about. Whereas when the first book came out, we didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Although I guess we should. So just to be clear, your first book in a sense kind of is more timeless, I guess, in the sense that, you know, it covers these core theoretical issues of how platforms work, what the issues are they have to solve, how the different kinds of network externalities, you know, same side and cross side work out. And so in that sense, it's going to be, it's not something that gets outdated quickly. Although, of course, you know, 10 years from now, the students reading the book won't even remember some of the examples. But
we will have to change the names. That's true.
Change but the names
not,
in that
not
case
the concepts. Yes,
right.
But the risk is that even though the second book will be out later than the first one, that the second edition of the second book might be out earlier than the second edition of the first book.
Yeah. Perhaps because of the need, because the competition landscape is much more of a
yes,
dynamic
indeed.
Thing. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm looking forward to seeing that book. All right. Well, we're just about out of time. So I wanted to say for those in the audience who are interested enough in these topics to have listened this far, I wanted to give a quick plug for our Masters of Applied Economics program that we offer here at the University of San Francisco, either for you if you're in that stage of life or if you have students or younger colleagues at your work who you advise and might be looking for their next step in graduate study. Our program focuses on the microeconomics of the digital economy, things like this textbook, which we've used as well. And in addition, couples that with a particular emphasis on learning the programming and analytic techniques, you know, working with data that are needed to get a job and start making an immediate contribution in the digital economy. And we're also conveniently located in San Francisco in the center of the global digital economy, next to both the headquarters of the old guard firms who've already got their network economics all set up, and of all the upstarts and startups that are hoping to replace them. So we are open to applications for this fall. So I wanted to say that, and then I also wanted to, Martin, give you a chance to tell people who would rather study in Europe what you have going on at Mannheim.
Yes, we like competition, so there are multiple master programs out there. And in Mannheim, we have set up a particular track which focuses on competition regulation economics, doing theory empirics, and also has a law component. So this is supposed to prepare people who are particularly interested in issues of competition economics and who are then likely to end up with competition authorities or economics consultancies. So this program and the track for that is available in Mannheim, has a very international intake, and we are very happy if we receive more applications.
And taught all in English, is that right?
It's taught all in English.
Great.
By people who speak English like me, yes.
I've definitely heard thicker accents than yours out there. So that sounds like should not be a challenge for anyone. Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. And this is the book is The Economics of Platforms, Concepts and Strategy by Paul Belflam and Martin Peitz. We had the privilege of talking to Martin today. And I encourage anyone who wants to have a deeper understanding of these topics to go out and get a copy of the book.